谢谢谢。
A boy in the room. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here with you this evening. I wish I'd had time for a nap before we started, but I know God is good and this will work out just fine. I was asked to pick a part of the book like while I was eating hot dogs and weenies in a bun or something and upstairs, and I just opened it. I mean, you can read anything in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. It's my favorite part. So that's a qualifier for that. I want to thank Polly for asking me to do this. I want to thank her for assigning me 17 hostesses. I'm a bit of a troublemaker, and Polly knows that. So trying to keep me in line is it's what an order. I can't go through with it. So I've got plenty of people watching me, so the hotel's in safe condition for the weekend, I suppose. If you're a Facebooker, go ahead and do that during the meeting. I know how difficult it is to put the phone away, but just, you know, just say things like the speaker's really hot, you know, or something. And I do want to welcome all my Facebook friends. I have friends in this room who I only know on Facebook. I want to tell you you're a lot taller in real life. And I want to say a special thank you to my friends who I've known for years that are here that I just don't get to see very often. This is like a real party for me, and I'm not a party girl. This is a real party for me. So thank you for letting me be here and be a part of it. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol though until I was 13 years old, and. And I'm really sorry. Oh, you know, before I tell my story, though, I want to thank Sonia, too. Sonia's on fire. Isn't that great? That's like... You know, we come to these things and we inspire one another. And I heard Sonia sing in Nashville last year, a year and a half ago, and I was inspired, and I wanted to do that. And so I joined a rock band, and... We tried several positions for me to be in that band, and they finally assigned me air tambourine. I don't have a beat. I mean, I did this wrong, so if anybody has a band and they're looking for an air tambouriner, I'm your girl. So anyway, thank you, Sonia. I appreciate that, and I look forward to hearing it. It'll get me to every meeting, I'll tell you, knowing that we're going to have singing. I mean, Polly's pretty clever. It's kind of like the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when they wrote the steps, they wrote a promise. With every one of the 12 steps, there's a promise. I mean, I'm like, I need prizes. If I'm going to... We hear about the 9th step promises a lot, but we don't always hear about the promises for every... But there's promises for every step, because we need, if we're going to do the work, we need prizes. So now we have like a prize for coming to the meeting. Sonia's going to sing. It's spectacular. So anyway, I'll get on with it. Let me make sure I got everything on in the right order. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. And quite frankly, I should have started a lot sooner. But I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking, I can't wait until I drink. I didn't ever think I would never drink. I just didn't think about drinking at all. And yet, I'm 13 years old. I'm on a camping trip. We're on the beach in Southern California, just south of Oceanside. And I remember this Friday night as clearly as if it were tonight. I remember getting into the tent that Friday night, and in my pillowcase, I had a bottle of vodka. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I have always believed it was the grace of God. But I've never been able to confirm that. But the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about that alcoholics, we have a sense of ease and comfort that comes before we take a drink. I mean, just knowing we're going to get a drink. I had a sense of ease and comfort knowing I was going to get a drink before I'd ever had a drink of alcohol. Because I had a sense of ease and comfort holding that bottle of vodka. I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I, looked around the tent, nothing had gotten different, nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. After that day, I never offered anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have resentments out there, but one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink, and you described it. You talked about how it felt in your mouth. You felt this warmth as it trickled down your throat. And you felt it as it hit your stomach, and it hit your stomach, and it exploded. And it went to your fingernails and your toenails, and you grew a couple inches. You dropped 20 pounds. Your pimples fell off. I mean, wonderful things happened to you, and that simply wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief tonight that if I were to drink a bottle of anything, in about 15 minutes, I'd have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse. I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I could not move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking, I would discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. I know, the second person's got to be very careful about what they're doing, but I didn't know that at 13. I didn't know. I somehow knew that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the good people told me my entire problem that night had been my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines, I was being dive-bombed, I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. When I came to in the morning, I couldn't realize nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until I realized I'd been sick all night long. I was like, you've never been sick. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in there either. So I got out, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. And that was the first drink of my entire life, and it was the most wonderful, marvelous, incredible, fabulous, magnificent, spiritual thing I'd ever done. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis from that day until the day it came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I just recently found out that they make vanilla extract without alcohol in it anymore, which I think is a total ripoff for our children. But I remember the day the guy at the market called me over. He said, Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore. He says, I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do. And I cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I'll tell you what, I still have a weakness. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and laugh at your neck. Which may answer the question as to why Polly gave me 17 hostesses. But you know, alcoholics, we know this stuff. You know, non-alcoholic people, they don't know what we know. We know stuff that they don't know. My next-door neighbor is not alcoholic. My next-door neighbors have been to my house a few times. They've never once eaten or drank a single thing out of my bathroom. And yet, We know this stuff. We know this stuff. And we don't talk about it. But I'm a bar drinker. I'm a living room drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, a backyard drinker, an office drinker, a dumpster drinker, a park drinker. I don't really specialize. I just drink. But I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. I see a couple of women in here who I know have been to a few of them, but they're the ones with sawdust on the floor. The mirror's cracked. You kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. The poultry around the bar is ripped where people tried to hold on as they're falling off their bar stool. And they used to be full of smoke. In California, you can't smoke in a bar anymore, which makes absolutely no sense to me. I drink in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall. Apparently, they can still do that, but they can't smoke in there. But they used to be full of smoke, and they had that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. I have friends that go to 7 a.m. attitude adjustment meetings. If I need my attitude adjusted, I go buy one of those joints. I open the door, I take a hit off of that, and it just perks me up for the rest of the day. But I, like so many of you, I'm sure, were stunned by the quality of people who drank in there. There were like CEOs of really big companies. There were bank presidents. There were admirals in the Air Force. There were neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were. But we weren't sitting around having conversations like, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva? I mean, we weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State, graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. I share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. Now, in hindsight, I can tell you I was a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I love blackouts. Love, 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 love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I know. Nothing more exciting for me than leaving work on May 12th, going back on May 18th, and discovering I'd been there the entire time. It just makes the time between paychecks so much shorter, but I love blackouts. I'm a blackout drinker, and I graduated college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed at San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something good, I want to keep doing it. Apparently, I do school well, so I just stayed. And I took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. My disease manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because there's a woman who's annoyed with me in San Diego, and this woman's looking for me to kill me. And to this day, I pray that she has found Al-Anon and released me. But here's the thing. I'm in a bar drinking, and this guy says to me, he says, I'm too drunk to drive. Well, I don't know about you, but I always drove a little better when I had a few. And I don't understand too drunk to drive, but you know what? I'll give you a ride home. So the bar would close. Being a lady of my word, I drove him home. And we drove and we drove and we drove and we drove. We finally get to his house. And my first cue that things might not have been all right, he said, now you have to be very quiet. Well, all right. So we go in and we get in this bedroom. And my second clue that things might not have been all right was there were two twin beds. But he got them together so quickly, you hardly noticed there had been two of them. And then we started fooling around and one thing led to another. And boy, I used to know what it led to, but anyway, I had to go to the bathroom, which I really thought was my only character defect when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, was a weak bladder. So I go to the bathroom, and now I'm ready to play. So I come down the hallway, I run into the room, I leap into the air, I do this Tarzan yell, I hit the bed, and when I hit the bed, this woman started screaming so loud. And there I was, stark naked in bed with his wife. And next thing I know, he's stark naked at the door trying to explain that we're cousins, we haven't seen each other in 10 years. And this woman's looking for me to kill me. I don't think I'm leaving San Diego because she's looking for me to kill me. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. And I'm going to tell my roommate, another thing that I never understood, men say this, I have no place to stay tonight. I mean, it's like their pickup line, but it's so non-creative. I have no place to stay. My wife doesn't understand. You know what? I have a tremendous amount of compassion. I'll take you home with me when the bar closes. So the bar would close, and I would take him home with me. And we would get to my house, and I would point to the bedroom over here on the left, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. He'd go into the bedroom on the left. I would go into my bedroom on the right, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, a lot of times, she was okay with that. A lot of times, it didn't bother her at all. Other times, within a matter of minutes, Bailey's banging on my bedroom door, which I had, of course, locked. I have 7 o'clock classes. I got to get some rest. And if she'd have been, you'd have drank with her. She was so inconsistent. But if I didn't think I was leaving, God, I didn't think I was leaving because she was annoyed with me. I thought I was leaving because I'd taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. Didn't think I was leaving because I had one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And and here's the thing. I'm driving down the street. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer walks up. Now, the first thing I do is slam my car door open. My intent is to knock him in the private parts. But men are a little fussy about their private parts, so if the door is flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, for me, it's really a good thing, because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I go for him. And it'd be a really good fight. I was a lot younger then, but it was a really good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon, be 2 or 3 of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. I say, Uncle Lenny, take me away. Next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open, try and knock him in the private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away and get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and go for him. Good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. And pretty soon, it's 3 or 4 of them, one of me. Oh, it's not fair anymore. It's Uncle, and they take me away. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. I never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him. And when you get out of the car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight, drunk driving assault. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing. It just was. I drank during the time when the state of California didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're kind of testy about it now, but I never had any consequence. Well, they took my license from me, but you don't really need that to drive a car. I never had any consequence. I paid an attorney a lot of money, and he'd write a letter, he'd make a phone call, that'd be the end of it. I'd never hear any more about it. And but one time I had 2 pending at the same time, and my attorney was nervous. And I think if your attorney's nervous, I think you need to worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney was nervous. And I just struck up a conversation with this guy sitting next to me, and as luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary. And I came up with a plan. I think alcoholics, I think we come up with really good plans really quickly. Now, unfortunately for me, typically my solutions are worse than the original problem. Which is why at 38 years sober, I am still actively sponsored. Because still today, my solution can be worse than the actual problem. But I didn't have a sponsor then. So we went over the mortuary. We got a death certificate. We put my name on it. We filled out all the pertinent information. We poured the doctor's signature and we sent it to the court because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. And I called my attorney and told him he didn't need to worry, and he didn't worry, I didn't worry, nobody worried for, I don't know, 60, 90, 200 days, I don't know what it was, when the light came on behind me again. And this time the judge wanted to see me, and I couldn't figure out why he wanted to see me. He never wanted to see me before, but you know what, I'm game, I'll go. I'll never forget him sitting there looking at me. He said, "Miss Ochoa," he said, "tell me, how is a dead person standing in my court?" And I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity, I said, "I don't know, bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. Never occurred to me. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I was offered a job in Northern California. It's about as far north as you could get from San Diego. And I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took some booze. I took some beer. And I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which isn't the place you want to shoot for. But I got to Santa Ana. I was out of booze. And I was thirsty. And I pulled off the freeway. I was sense I could find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful used booze, urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got. 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my lover, my friend, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned, I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. At some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings, and long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every area of my life, where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the big oak desk. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about, I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards, and we often won awards. I didn't tell you about the times that I would come out of a blackout standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I would have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous so that I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge. In 1975, the state of California was starting to get a little irritated at people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in their breathalyzer above their grade point average. And I got pulled over one more time. And I was doing a good job. I didn't mention to the officer, I really thought I was doing A-plus work on the field sobriety test. I'm good at field sobriety tests. I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, and I read it. I find out where I made my mistake so I can practice that part. So that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time because I had a very high-profile job, and the cops were always looking for me. They knew what I drove if I had my car, a company car, your car, a stolen car. They always knew what I drove, and they were always looking for me. So I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And when I prayed God was the last one, I knew heel to toe, I know finger to nose, I can do the whole, I can stand on one foot for 45 minutes. I mean, I'm really good at field sobriety tests. And at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I'd responded with, "Well, I can't even do that sober." Well, and just confessed, and he took me away, so on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, "Okay," and I turned around. See, you think it was funny. He wasn't even amused. I was turned around. He cuffed me, took me to Orange County Jail. He put me in a cell with criminals. I mean, there were real criminals in there. I mean, real criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. There were prostitutes in there. There were burglars. Women who'd been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California they lock you up for it. And I tried to organize a prison break. I explained very carefully to the criminals, and it was an easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups. We're going to bang them out in the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm around her neck. We're getting her keys, and we're getting out of here. I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me, and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" I said, "Fine, then you all stay, but I'm getting out." I was going like a mad woman on those bars. A couple problems with styrofoam cups. First one is they don't make a lot of noise. Second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And the bars ate them up, and it got to my knuckles, and it got painful. I sat down, and I shut up. I got released on an OR. I hadn't been released on an OR in a long time, but I got released on an OR that night, and I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I was drunk in court that morning. It's the only way I went to court. The laundromat, the grocery store, the day of the $1,000 attorney was gone. The only thing I wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer, and I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. Anything in a drink, I took a drink. Only I told you I'd retired. And I was retired at 26 years old, and I had the public defender standing next to me. And because the state of California was starting to get upset about drunk driving, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. In the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different, and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance," and he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went through some mental gymnastics in that courtroom that morning, but I finally selected the alternative that he was offering. I left the courtroom, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity, but I drank with a sense of urgency and desperation I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, I accessed God's grace. I believe God's grace has always surrounded me. God has always held me in the palm of his hand, but I have never been able to access it. You see, I built a big brick wall between me and you. Seems to me my whole life people hurt me, they disappointed me, and they let me down. My parents told me they loved me anymore, their love, and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and spiritually abusive. People told me they'd be there for me, and they weren't. And I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. I remember clearly as a small child making a decision, I just don't want to be hurt anymore. And I began to build a big brick wall between me and you. And that brick wall worked. It kept you out. What I didn't know about that brick wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And when you live behind that wall, you don't believe and you don't trust. And behind that wall, I've never been able to access God's grace. But on October 4th, 1975, I know I accessed God's grace. And the reason I can tell you that I did and that I know it is because I didn't take a drink of alcohol that day. And it never occurred to me to not take a drink of alcohol. I never planned to not take a drink. I never thought about not taking a drink. I never tried to control and enjoy my drinking. I just drank. And that day, I didn't take a drink of alcohol. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that meeting, I heard that we don't drink between meetings. I looked around, didn't see me drinking in the meeting. And I thought, for the love of God, they're not drinking in the meeting. They don't drink between the meetings. When do you drink? I couldn't understand why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And you just heard my story. You just heard my story, but I could not figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard was that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I went home and read it. I couldn't find the answers. I couldn't even find the questions. And that's who came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent. I was that when I was asleep. Without alcohol, I'm angry. Without alcohol, I cover that anger, and I acted out in rage. Without alcohol, I come to your meetings, and I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. I have a driving problem. Not an alcoholic. And I'd sit in the back of the room, and the speaker would be talking, and I'd get annoyed, and I'd stand up, and I'd start telling him what I thought about him. And it was usually profanities, but I put it together in such a way it sounded like a sentence. And I'd finish, and some little blue-haired lady about my age now would turn around and say, "Keep coming back," and I'd flip her off and wave my court card in her face. Tell her I didn't have a choice. I don't have a choice. I have this court card. I don't have a choice. I would get upset. We at the Canyon Club, we have tables like this, and there's like 8 people sitting on them, and I'd get upset, and I'd stand up and take the table, which impacts about 30 people. I carry a knife in my boot. I would throw it at the literature rack. Always aimed at the piece of literature a member's eye view. I didn't always hit that, but that's what I aimed at, and that's what came to your meetings. And because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous understood the traditions, you never told me to leave. You just kept saying, keep coming back. I think you meant to other meetings, but but you just kept saying, keep coming back. And I keep coming back and keep coming back. And here's what happened to me. I came to your silly meetings. I argued with you. I fought at you. I kicked at you. I spit at you. I threw my coffee at you. But the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous shared exactly the way the book Alcoholics Anonymous says to share. They talked about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And when you told your story, your alcoholism touched mine. I carry a coin in my pocket that says, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. Because when you told your story, your alcoholism came through that brick wall, and it touched my alcoholism. I am always, always concerned when men and women get up to podiums and meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, I'm not going to do it drunk the log. We all know how to drink. Please tell your story. Because it was in the men and women telling their stories and touched my alcoholism. And touching my alcoholism, and it wasn't one meeting, 10 meetings a week, 2 weeks, 3 months. 8.5 months away from my last drink, I was in worse pain than I had ever been in. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. 8.5 months away from my last drink, one more person told their story, and their alcoholism touched mine, and mine woke up. And it was an incredibly painful moment for me. And the pain of that moment drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And the book says this is the first step in recovery. I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And I took the first step in recovery. I wish I could tell you then that I was so happy that I looked at the rest of the steps. But that's not my story. I stayed angry. The obsession to drink for me lasted for 2 years. For 2 years, I wanted to drink more than I wanted to breathe. So my experience is this. You can have an obsession to drink, and you don't have to drink. And I continued to sit in those meetings, and I heard you talk about what it used to be like, and I heard you talk about what it's like today. And I heard you talk about what happened. And sitting in that meeting, listening to you talk about what happened, there's a line in the book, We Agnostics, where it says, I don't know where it is. Oh. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. I think for the next several months, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with that question in my mind. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. Because I heard you talk about a spiritual basis. I heard you talk about the things that you did. I heard you talk about your life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you talk about the spiritual basis, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. I don't think by alcoholic death, I don't think either that Bill means lay down and let him put dirt on your face. I think the alcoholic death that Bill talks about is to continue to live in the incomprehensible demoralization, to continue to live in the despair, to continue to live sitting on bar stools, dreaming dreams and planning plans, and not being able to get off the bar stool and get it done. To continue to live promising the people we love, our mothers, our fathers, our husbands, our wives, our lovers, our brothers, our sisters, promising the people we love, I'll never do it again. And meaning that promise with every fiber in my body. And then I do it again. And then I see that look in their eye. That look that says, "Why? What's wrong with me? Don't you love me? What did I do?" I think that's the alcoholic death that Bill talks about. And I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous listening to you share your experience, strength, and hope for a period of time juggling that question, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. I think the second step when it says came. Came. That's what I did. I came. And I came, and I came, and I came, and I came. And then it says came to. And I came to the day that I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I came to sitting here listening to you share what it's like today. And I came to believe that the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous were telling me the truth. I came to believe that you had done the things that you said you had done to get to where you are, where you say you are now. I came to believe. I came to believe that a power greater than myself, and for me that power was you. I hear people in AA all the time talking about the second step, and they're talking about some trying to find God idea, some trying to define God, some trying to get right with God, something about God. It's not about God. It's came to believe that a power greater than me. A little secret ahead of time for tomorrow. In the 11th step, it says, self through prayer and meditation to improve a conscious contact. So you got a whole bunch of steps to go from two. To get to 11, where you're going to improve this relationship that's going to develop over the course of the steps. So it wasn't about finding God, or it wasn't about getting right with God, or it wasn't about me deciding if my God of my childhood was the one I want to bring in day eight. God brought me in day eight. I don't think God's at all concerned about who I'm bringing with me. But I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. I came to believe that I could, that, you see, I spent my whole life trying to think my way into right living. I'm a thinker. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start to try not to think about what I'm thinking while I'm thinking. I'll tell you what, I'm grateful. I'm grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head. But everything I thought came barreling out. That would be truly humiliating. I don't hear it so much anymore. We used to tell newcomers, don't think. I don't know how you do that. I really don't know how you do it. But I used to try and think my way into, I'm very intellectual. I'm very smart. I have a college degree, after all. I'm very smart. I used to try and think my way into right living. What I came to believe in this step, that this power greater than myself, what would happen was I would act my way into right thinking. You see, I was raised Catholic, and I love the Catholic Church. I have no qualms with the Catholic Church. I like to go there. I like all of it. I like the ritual. I like when they serve me brunch. I don't have any qualms with them. Because, you see, I have a hearing problem. It's not what the nuns said. It's how I heard it. But what I heard them say is I was going to burn for just as long for thinking it as I was for doing it. And I've always been a kind of into action person. And I figure if I'm going to burn for thinking it, I'm going to get some enjoyment out of doing it. So I did things that I didn't even want to do. I'll tell you what, I did things that if I'd have known about steps 4, 5, 8, and 9, I would not have done. But in step 2, I came to believe that the day would come that I could have a thought and I wouldn't have to take an action on it. Another little secret for tomorrow, little peekaboo ahead. In step 10, it says, for by this time sanity will have been restored. Which indicates for me that what I come to believe in step 2 is not going to happen until I do take the action of the rest of the steps. Now, it happened a little bit. It happened enough that I could have a thought, I didn't have to take a drink. I could have a thought, a little obsessive thought, I didn't have to take somebody to bed. I mean, it happened enough, and it happened slowly. But that's what I came to believe. I came to believe I could have a thought, and I wouldn't have to take an action on it. Came to believe a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. I love the chapter, We Agnostics. I think there's some very, very powerful information in there, but I'm not so sure it has a lot to do with the second step. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis? I was being asked that question in court that morning, and I didn't know that's the question I was being asked. I thought I was being asked, do you want to go to prison for 10 years or do you want to do an alternative? That's what I thought I was being asked. My disease, rationalization, justification, and denial. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. Somebody else does too, clearly. Well, I never wanted to be a mother, but I found out that's not adequate birth control. And that day in court, I was standing there. I was a single parent. I was self-supporting to my own contributions. I told the judge he couldn't put me in jail because I had this kid. I didn't like him. He didn't do anything. He went and he cried. You'd think at 8 months old, he'd get a little part-time job, but... But I was willing to use him that morning, and the judge told me he'd put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother, and I was going to prison to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. It was a tough decision for me. It was a tough decision. And God did for me that day what I couldn't do for myself, because I picked the alternative and I came to you. And I have continued to pick the alternative and come to you. I come to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to at least 5 meetings a week, sometimes more than that. And I go to that many meetings for this reason. My disease needs to stay alive. I need to come here and listen to you tell your story. I'm telling mine tonight, but you're going to tell yours tomorrow. And you're going to tell yours the next day, and you're going to tell yours. And we're going to be sitting having coffee, and you're going to tell yours, and your disease is going to touch mine. We all have a story, and it's our responsibility to tell it. And I come to meetings to hear your story, so that my alcoholism can stay alive. My alcoholism's like a little tiger pup inside of me. It's a cute little thing. You know how cute tiger pups are? I don't own one, but I've seen pictures of them. They're like cuddly. They look like they're a lot of fun. They're frisky. They're cuddly. A lot of fun. That's my alcoholism. My alcoholism is this little tiger pup inside of me. When I fell to my knees and I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, when I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, that little tiger pup fell asleep. And that little tiger pup's still in there sleeping. It's alcoholism, it's not alcoholism. That tiger pup is in there sleeping. And nothing's going to wake him up. But you know what? Even asleep, he's growing. He's growing bigger and bigger and bigger. And now he's a full-blown tiger. I mean, they are mean, they are vicious, they're killers. Full-blown tiger in there. But he can't hurt me because he's asleep. And the only thing that'll wake him up is a drink of alcohol. And I need to keep him asleep. So I come to you and you tell your story, and it's like singing a lullaby to my tiger. Every time you tell your story, you sing a lullaby to my tiger. We were upstairs at the, I don't know what it was, a free-for-all food thing up there. And I thought, you know what, Polly throws a good party. There was a whole shelf of booze over on the left hand. It wasn't just for us, it was for the whole hotel, but there's a whole shelf of booze over there, and I don't know if it was Sandy or Cheryl, because I get them mixed up, but they don't look anything alike, but I met them at the same time, so. Met them at the same time, and I'm 65, you know, feel my pain, but one of them was, I forgot the whole story I was going to tell. That's the other part about being 65. Oh, yeah. So I said, God, look at that over there. And she hadn't even noticed it was there. I'm like, are you really an alcoholic? So I was going to take a picture of it, and one of them offered to take the picture for me. I said, no, I'm okay. I'm not afraid of it. My tiger's asleep right now. And my tiger can stay is because of step one, because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, because one alcoholic talking to another is where recovery begins. Step one and two for me are the cornerstone of a tremendous amount of way of life. You're powerless. Well, that's pretty hopeless. Here's some hope. The people in AA are telling you the truth. Nobody in AA has ever lied to me. You have never lied to me when you've told me what you have done. You've lied to me. Something, you know. Like, no, I know you're not size 8. But you've never lied to me when you've shared with me what you have done. You've never lied to me. The people in AA are telling me the truth. Come to believe the people in AA are telling me the truth. My life's unmanageable. Not much hope in that either. But when you share what it's like for you today, I hear manageable lives. I hear the ability to go to work and not drink. I hear the ability to be a daughter and not drink. I hear the ability to be a friend and not drink. I hear the ability to play softball and not drink. I hear manageability. My life's not unmanageable today. As long as I come here and listen to you share your experience and you allow me to take your experience in the world and live it. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. but you give me hope by sharing your experience, strength, and hope. I am pleased. I don't know how long I'm supposed to talk, but I'm out of spit, and and I have COPD, and I'm out of oxygen. So I am. I'm going to end with a story that has nothing to do with steps one or two. So this is my rebellion. I believe in being a service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you ought to have a job. No matter where you are, you ought to have a job. And no matter what you do in life, you need to be a part of. You need to add to, no matter what it is. We learn how to do it here by cleaning up after meetings. We take it out in the world with us. And I was in a hospital in November 29, 2006, when my grandson was born. And I was photographing the birth of my grandson. And at one point, the doctor said to me, he said, this is a good shot. And I thought, I know a little about the female anatomy, and this is not a good shot. And just about then, my grandson's head was born. And the doctor turned the head, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I looked behind him at his mother, and I looked into the eyes of God, and I looked behind her at my son, and I looked into the eyes of God. And at that moment, I realized, for at that time, 31 years, you've allowed me to stand here and look into the eyes of God. A brick at a time, you have taken down that brick wall that I had built between me and you. Because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can stand here and look into the eyes of God. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.